Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac Dover.
President Trump talked about you last night. Let me read what he said at his rally in Pennsylvania. He was talking about Arnold Schwarzenegger failed when he did the show. He was talking about The Apprentice, and he was a movie star. So he likes to talk about you. What's your current thought on him?
Well, first of all, I think it's very nice to call me a movie star. So that's very nice. But, you know, I really never know exactly why the Russians make him say certain things. I mean,
Here's the episode we've been talking about, our live interview with Arnold Schwarzenegger, recorded Sunday at the South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas. There's a lot to hear in this one, so I'll keep the introduction short. It was the two of us on stage talking about President Trump, environmentalism, the Me Too movement, and more. He had a lot to say, and actually a lot of jokes to crack. But as I told the audience there, I couldn't think of a better person for that crowd to talk about the collision of politics and entertainment and craziness that we're all living through and how to maybe make more sense of it going forward. So, Zach and I headed down to Austin, and in a room of about 1,000 people, the governor and I went through a lot. I know we had him on last summer, but he seemed worth going another round with. Hope you'll agree. And you'll also hear some of the audience questions that came up along the way, down to his favorite kind of dessert and his future political plans. Remember to subscribe. Coming up, a killer group of conversations with Texas Senate candidate Beto O'Rourke, Washington Post columnist Jennifer Rubin, Mayor Pete Buttigieg, Puerto Rico Governor Ricardo Rossello, Stockton Mayor Michael Tubbs, Congressman Matt Gaetz, and many more. Follow me on Twitter and on Facebook at Isaac Dover, and if you scroll back on Twitter, you'll be able to see the photo I talked about on stage and tweeted from on stage of me and Schwarzenegger at the Arnold Schwarzenegger Museum in Austria when we were there together last fall. And now, live from the South by Southwest stage.
We had a podcast last summer with Arnold Schwarzenegger, but I thought who would be better to be here today with us than the governor. I will tell you that my own, people say like, oh, he needs no introduction. He doesn't really need an introduction, right? That's why you're all here. My own experiences with him include a podcast that, like I said, that we did where he commandeered a room in a committee room on Capitol Hill and said, this is where we're doing it. We didn't tell the guards or anyone else. We ended up in Oktoberfest together in Munich last September. I was working on an article about all the causes that he is focusing on in his post-political life. And then I saw him a couple months ago on the steps of the Supreme Court talking about gerrymandering after there was the big case argued there. And of course, he told a Terminator joke and looked right at the Capitol and told one of his favorite lines, which is that syphilis has a better approval rating than Congress right now. We've got some things to talk about. And with that, I'll just welcome Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger to the stage. Sir? All right. So,
First of all, yeah. Isaac, I just wanted to say it was not syphilis, it was herpes.
Herpes, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was herpes. No, because
where is syphilis rate?
Well, syphilis is even lower.
Okay.
Much lower than Congress. I mean, it's just,
I'm sorry. One of them, I got my venereal diseases okay. Mixed up. let's just get it out of the way. President Trump talked about you last night. Let me read what he said at his rally in Pennsylvania. He was, just sort of as an aside, was talking about Arnold Schwarzenegger failed when he did the show. He was talking about The Apprentice, and he was a movie star. So he likes to talk about you. What's your current thought on him?
Well, first of all, I think it's very nice to call me a movie star, so that's very nice. But, you know, I really never know exactly why the Russians make him say certain things. I mean, you know, it's beyond me. And why he would even think about those kind of things is also beyond me, because, I mean, he's supposed to be very busy. I mean, he promised the people to do infrastructure. We have launched now the third or the fourth week infrastructure, and then he gets always in his own way.
Yeah,
and then you know, he talked about healthcare reform, he talked about immigration reform, and there's so many kind of issues that need to be addressed that he's not addressing, but he's thinking more about those kind of things, you know. So, and plus, let's be honest, I mean, he also promised us to drain the swamp, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it just so what happened? I mean, here everything goes on as usual now in Washington. I mean, people are spending more and more of the taxpayers' money, millions of dollars. Secretaries of various different departments spending, you know, millions of dollars. Some of them are caught flying with a private plane, and others are caught, you know, spending, you know, $31,000 of getting a new dining room set in their office. And then the Secretary of the Interior has been caught with spending $139,000 on a new door.
Well, doors are important.
So yeah, of course they're important, but I think the guy's confused. He thinks instead of being the Secretary of the Interior, he thinks it's the Secretary of Interior Design or something like that. I mean, there's just something
yeah,
off
I feel
there.
Like you
but
came
in any case,
with the one line.
My office still stands to Donald Trump, and that is, you know, if he's such an expert in TV, why don't we switch jobs? He takes on the job and goes back to Celebrity Apprentice, and I go and take his job, and then people will finally be able to sleep.
I feel like maybe we'll come back and talk. He likes attacking you, but you have an approach where you don't want to engage with him all the time. So talk that through a little bit.
Well, I'm not the shadow government or something like that. You know, so this is my thing is, I've always actually supported every president after they were elected, because I believe very strongly after the people have spoken, we should support the president, even though I did not vote for Donald Trump.
Who did you vote for?
I voted for the opposite. But in any case, the bottom
line... The
opposite
line, Hillary Clinton?
The bottom line is that I just feel like that after they're president, we should support them. If it is, was, you know, it's Trump, or if it is Obama, if it is Bush, it doesn't make any sense who it is. And only when we are united and work together, we can be really a great nation. And so this is what I still believe in today. But there are certain issues that are very, very dear to me and that I'm very sensitive about. I'm very sensitive about when it comes to the political system and that to have political reform, to have redistricting reform. So obviously when he then says, no, we shouldn't do redistricting reform, then I said to myself, what happened with this whole idea of draining the swamp and switching things out and improving things? Or, for instance, when he does tax reform and he gives billions and billions of dollars to people that really don't need it. Like, I'm benefiting from his tax reform, but in the meantime, he's taking $1.2 billion away from children for after-school programs.
So you don't want the money?
So, of course, I don't need the money. I don't need the money. Keep it to the kids. The kids need the money. The money needs to be in the classroom. We need after-school programs because we've established the fact already. And this is something that I've been involved with for the last 25 years, that for every dollar we put into an after-school program, we get $3 back. We save $3. And this is why in California, Democrats have endorsed it, Republicans have endorsed it, and it has been extremely successful in California, where every elementary and middle school has after-school programs. And so I'm fighting for that budget. So I will be going to Washington and will be lobbying Congress to make sure that they keep that money in and save those kids and keep them in after-school programs and, if possible, even increase the budget.
The last time you saw President Trump directly was at a Wrestling Hall of Fame event. Is that right?
Donald Trump and I, we have run into each other many times, and we have actually been very friendly with each other and have been friends. And you know, we ran into, he was in the professional wrestling, and so was I. He's in the real estate, so was I. And so there was a lot of common interest, show business and so on and so forth. I think that our thing just crossed a little bit when he asked me to endorse him. And I said, no, I said, because you don't believe that there's climate change and you don't believe that there's 9 million people out there dying because of pollution. I think that you should really go and fight, you know, the fossil fuels and really create a clean and green energy future for our children and grandchildren. And he didn't want to have any of it. And so therefore, I said, you know, I cannot endorse you.
I'm curious, one of the things that we've heard in the last couple of weeks in the response to the Parkland shooting is President Trump has talked a lot about violent movies and violent video games and that's part of the solution here. You've been in a lot of violent movies. You've been in video games, too. And you have disagreed with this in the past. Do you see any credibility to that argument that that's where we go in this conversation?
No. First of all, I believe that we should look at everything whenever there's a problem like that. We should never close out anything. So, of course, they can look at, you know, violent content in movies and video games and all that kind of stuff. I just always believed that, you know, violence has been written about in books. And if you look at the Bible, that's the most violent book there is. And in movies that they came about, I don't think this is really the thing that really contributes to the violence. It's just my personal opinion. I'm not an expert in that subject, but I think that we should address all the various different issues because it's inexcusable what's going on today. But I think that also, and I'm very glad that the children are marching. I'm glad that the children are rising up and doing something about it. This is the greatest news that I've seen in a sense this happened. Because I feel like the children do not get represented in America. It doesn't matter which state capital it is or if it is the federal government, children are always left behind. And so I thought that children should rise up already a long time ago when it comes to equal education in America. We don't have equal education. There's a lot of people that talk about it, but they don't really act out equal education. Otherwise, we wouldn't need affirmative action. If everyone would get an equal start and the equal amount of attention, every school gets the equal amount of money, has the equal amount of quality teachers and after-school programs and everything, the full attention, then that is called equal education. I remember when I became governor in California, the first thing I had to do is settle a lawsuit with the ACLU. Because the Democrats in our state fought the ACLU. Because the ACLU said that California doesn't have really equal education. And the Democrats said, and it was the state's position, that this is not our responsibility. But the fact is that it is our responsibility. And so when I came in, I settled the lawsuit, and we got billions of dollars to then contribute to the various different schools that fell behind, to give each school equal amount of homework material and learning material and computers and to fix the schools and so on. I mean, in some schools you go into, there's inner city schools where there's 6 or 8 stalls, bathroom stalls that are closed and blocked up for 6 months at a time. Right. It's crazy. That's not what you call equal education and equal opportunities.
Let's talk a little bit about how you did things as governor and what you think maybe can carry forward. We talked about this a little bit, and you boil it down to a couple principles. And so one of them is develop an inclusive team. And I don't want to spend all this time contrasting you to President Trump, but just for the sake of this, we have in President Trump a cabinet that is all Republicans, that White House advisors, with a very few exceptions, are all Republicans, largely white. All of the top cabinet officials are white men. Why does that matter? He would tell you he's just hiring the best people, and he's not getting caught up in the PC stuff that other people do. But you had a female Democrat as your chief of staff. Republicans were mad about that in California, and you spent a lot of time on diversity appointments.
Well, I mean, look, America is Democrats and Republicans and independents. So this is the whole pot. And I would say that America, without any doubt, is the smartest country in the world and the greatest country in the world, the best country in the world and the strongest country in the world and all of those kind of things. So if I would just hire now half of the people, just Republicans, then I would take the other half out of the ballgame and I only would play with a half a team. And I think that's not fair to the American people.
But do you think it changes the way that you acted as governor?
No, what it means is that you got to have the brain power of Democrats and Republicans and independents and of women and of men, and it doesn't matter what it is, you got to have a nice, good mixture. You got to be inclusive so that you really have the ultimate brain power represented here. And especially when you are in a kind of a problem situation. Remember, when I took over as governor, we just had the recall.
Right.
And
that's how you got to be governor.
That's right. And Democrats and Republicans were fighting about every single thing. And nothing was getting done. And we had a huge budget deficit. We had the debt. We had everything that you can think of. Everything was wrong. So it was clear to me that I wanted to go and to have a diverse group. and not only deal with Republicans, but also with Democrats, and to bring them into the office. And this is the team of rivals, like mm-hmm. President Lincoln did that. You know, when he won, he realized that he didn't really have 50% of the votes, so he needed at least to solidify the Republican Party and bring all of the people that criticized him and attacked him during the presidential campaign, bring them in and make them part of the team. And I think that is very healthy to do, and I think that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to bring Democrats and Republicans, women, men, and every. And of course, my Republican Party criticized me for that. I remember they asked me to come across the street to the hotel where we always talked about politics, and because you couldn't do it in the Capitol. And they started attacking me and says, how could you dare have a female chief of staff that is from the Democratic Party? And she is also
a
lesbian.
So which was the problem? Was a woman, a lesbian, or a Democrat? Which was
maybe for them it was all of them a problem. But I mean, the ones were screaming that she's a brawl-burning, you know, lesbian from San Francisco. Oh, San Francisco was another problem, major problem. And so I said, they attacked me about all of those kind of things. So I looked around and I said, I'm a little confused here. I said, I did not know that the Republican Party is in charge of staffing my office and hiring the people. And they said, no, we are not. And they said, well, then don't tell me what to do. Why don't you just you know, figure out a way of making the Republican Party more popular in California? So we
that
don't slip
worked,
all the time.
Right? The Republican Party wasn't more popular in California.
Well, it was slipping. It was very strong at one point, and then it was slipping because the Republican Party started getting away from the basic Republican principles and started to get more and more right-wing, which is, of course, leads us to the redistricting reform that I then went after. But, I mean, it was really unhealthy. They lost, you know, within a short period of time, 1 million women in the Republican Party. And the reason was because women were very much into the environmental issues, into healthcare issues, into education issues. And the Republicans didn't talk about that and didn't address those issues. I wanted to address those issues. So I started grabbing them from the Democrats because I said to myself, this is ludicrous to call this a Democratic issue or a Republican issue. This is a people's issue.
So one of your other principles of governing is no one gets a 10. So that's your art of the deal. What does that mean?
Well, for instance, when we did healthcare reform in California, we had all kinds of different groups of people there. We had the doctors there, the nurses, the drug companies, the hospital association, the medical association.
Cigarette companies.
We had the
right?
consumer watchdogs, the cigarette companies, the employees union. I mean, we had all of those different groups. So the room was packed with people. And I told him, I said, look, we can get healthcare reform done if we work very hard at it. I said, but the first and most important thing is that everyone has to be clear here that no one will walk out of here with a 10. Because what is a 10 to the consumer groups will not be a 10 at all to the hospital association. Will not be a 10 to the drug companies and will not be a 10 to the medical association. So I said, you, if you're lucky, you end up all with a 7. I said, but if you're comfortable with that idea that we can settle with a 7, I said, that's the thought you have to go back with to your people and think about that. I said, if you're ready to go and settle for a 7, we can do it.
Is that the problem in Washington? Everybody wants a 10?
Well, I think it is a problem of leadership because I think you got to really sit people down and you got to explain this is how we can arrive with a great decision, but everyone has to give a certain amount in order to make this happen.
Is that all on President Trump or are there other people who are
No, I think in general, I think this is, look, you have to, it's a relationship building. It is, you know, really having a very clear vision of where you want to go. You have to be able to bring people together. You have to bring people together that you may hate. You have to bring people together from all the different parties and everything. And I think that we, for instance, in California, we were very successful, except we were then on the end derailed because the Democrats, there was one Democratic senator that couldn't digest the idea that a Republican is going to get that victory of having healthcare reform. And there was another senator, female senator, that wanted to have single payer. So she fought for single payer and wouldn't settle for anything else. So those were the two groups of people that derailed it.
In the legislature, right? They passed it twice.
It passed in the assembly, And it did not pass in the Senate, like I said, because they didn't want us to have that kind of a victory.
And in the Assembly since, they've had Jerry Brown as governor, Democratic governor, have they passed a single payer?
No, of course not, because, you know, they sent me the single payer legislation all the time, and I vetoed it, because it doesn't work. I mean, I've seen it in Europe. It doesn't work. And that's just my opinion. You know, there's others that are experts and they may disagree with that, which is perfectly fine. But I just think it didn't work, and therefore I vetoed it. Now, since Jerry Brown is governor, the Democrats have never, ever sent him a bill about single payer, so he doesn't have to veto it.
I mean, it's
so,
sort
but
of
that's
like
politics. That's just
we had 60-plus votes for repealing Obamacare when Barack Obama was president, and then just the one House vote that failed and the one that passed and a Senate vote that failed, and then that's it. They've left it alone. It seems like a similar situation.
Well, first of all, I can tell you,
President Trump would sign Obamacare repeal, it seems.
It is a big mistake to try to do anything just on party line, because it would never stick. Because then eventually the other party comes into power and they will undo everything. And this is the same if it is with Obamacare, if it is now with the tax bill, you know, all of those things that are just strictly voted on party line will not stick and will not last a long time, nor do executive orders. I mean, the president can sign all the executive orders that they want. I mean, you saw what happened with Obama's executive orders. As soon as Trump came in, they were out the window. And as soon as Trump leaves office, they will be out the window, whatever he's signing right now. So I think that this is kind of like the easier way out. I think the right way to do it is to bring Democrats and Republicans together and to solve problems together. That is really the way to do it. It's very difficult to do, but it's the only way to do it.
You mentioned that you saw the way the healthcare system worked in Austria. When we talked for that podcast last summer, actually, you described that you feel like you have an American Arnold on one shoulder and an Austrian Arnold on the other shoulder. Can you explain what it is that you meant by that?
Well,
they were always fighting, right?
Well, people, it's very important to explain also why people are talking about that. And we were talking about it because we were having a schmoozing fest, and we were talking and you were asking
I don't think
me,
I've ever heard anybody use Yiddish words as much as you, actually.
Oh, yeah. Why not, right?
I'm okay with it.
But I mean, so the thing was we were just, you know, gibbitzing around. And
keep going, come on. I feel like we're going to have a Fiddler on the Roof production.
And you said to me, is this, you know, it's interesting because a lot of people say that you are just a Republican but name only.
Yeah.
Or they were confused because sometimes you had a Democratic idea and then sometimes it was a Republican idea. How did you justify for that and how do you explain that? That's when I said to Isaac, I said, well, I think what they forget is that I was born in Austria and I grew up in Austria. So that you have still an Austrian mentality mixed in with the American mentality. So that on one side is kind of the Austrian here, and on the other side is the American here, and they argue and fight all the time. So before I ever get in the room and have any battles with people and arguments about various different issues, I have my own battles. And so there's the Austrian and then the American. And so when it comes to, for instance, healthcare, that everyone is insured, that was my first question when I became governor. I said, this is ludicrous that we have almost 6 million people in California, in the richest state in the union, and the number one place in the world, 6 million people uninsured. Why is that? Let's fix it. We got to have everyone insured. And then all of a sudden, you know, people kept coming to me and saying, you know, you're not just bipartisan, you're bipolar. And and there were Republicans that were accusing me of that. And this were really nice people and everything. They were very helpful when I was campaigning and in many other issues, but they just hated the idea for me to do anything to talk about universal health care.
Well,
I try to tell people, I said, look, Teddy Roosevelt more than 100 years ago talked already about, you know, universal health care. President Nixon tried to actually have a health care reform in the 70s. He's a Republican. It's okay. It's a people's issue. It's not a Republican issue, but this was basically the Austrian speaking rather than I flipped and became a Democrat. So that's the issue that I'm talking about.
You mentioned Teddy Roosevelt. One of the other things, this is the way you put it, sort of an interpretation of Roosevelt, that you should use the carrot but have the stick ready. So tell me what you mean by that. The example that I was thinking of is when you would when you were doing the workers' comp, I think it was, right? When you were arguing, telling them that you would have a ballot initiative, right, if they didn't negotiate with you and started gathering signatures.
One of the first things, one of the biggest problems that we had for businesses in California when I became governor was that the workers' comp costs were increasing every year by 30-40%, and businesses were literally kind of been driven out of the state. They couldn't do business in California anymore. And so what I did was I promised the people that if they elect me governor, that I will go back and I will reform the system in such a way that we will lower the costs. We will lower the costs by at least 50%. I became governor and we started negotiating, and of course the negotiations didn't really go that well in the beginning. The way it looked was that it would create 20% savings, but not the 15% savings. So I went out simultaneously and started gathering signatures for a ballot initiative to put in that fall on the ballot. And so each time, as we were negotiating, I brought 10,000 or 20,000 more signatures to the table. And each time I brought more signatures to the table, we got more and more points that they would agree to. And eventually, when I had 1 million signatures, so this is approximately what you need, because you have to then discount and figure out that probably 250,000 are not good, and but you need, let's say, the 780. So we have enough. So I put this there, and I say to them during the negotiations, I have now 1 million signatures, and within 1 week, I will make the decision if we go on a ballot or not.
And did it
work? So this was kind of the stick idea. Yeah. And it totally worked because they agreed then to the rest of the points. They didn't want to go to the ballot because that meant that they would have, the costs would have been cut even more than 50%. It ended up actually within a year after it passing, we cut the costs by 62%, the workers' comp costs. And we saved over $70 billion over a period of several years to business in California. So businesses stayed in California because of that, and it was really a very, very successful thing. But it was
but
a perfect example of
the
carrot
pulpit,
and the
right? That's
stick.
Another thing that you think about a lot here, is how to use the bully pulpit, how to make bring the show into politics, right, in a real way.
Well, the bully pulpit, you know, for me was always kind of like everything. I mean,
well,
I'm a big, big believer in that.
I don't think anybody picked up on the fact.
No, but even when you think about in bodybuilding, there was no one really able to promote the sport of bodybuilding. But when I came on the scene and I became Mr. Olympia and Mr. Universe and all this, I went out there and I really spoke out about bodybuilding, the benefits of bodybuilding, why every athlete ought to do weight resistance training, and why the schools should have it, and why the universities should have it, and why it is a healthy thing to do and all this stuff. And so it was a lot of work that needed to be done. But we eventually turned it around and bodybuilding became a very popular activity. And now everyone is training, and every hotel in the world has a bodybuilding gym, a weight resistance gym, and the cardio gym, and all those kind of things.
I want to ask you, when we were in Europe together last fall, you ended up deciding that we needed to go to the Arnold Schwarzenegger Museum. Which is a thing. And it's in the house that you grew up in, which is in the hills outside of the city of Thal in Austria. And I said to you there, so what is it like to have your own museum? And you said to me, I don't think about it. And I said, what does that mean? And you said, to me, it's like everybody has their own museum. I don't know. Does anybody here have their own museum? Can you just explain what you mean by that? And while you do it, I'm going to tweet a photo. So we didn't know how to get it up on the screen in a way that would work out exactly. So I'm going to tweet a photo from my Twitter account of us touring the Arnold Schwarzenegger Museum with the governor pointing to a mannequin of him in his bodybuilding days that's in what was his parents' bedroom. So what is that? Everybody has a museum?
Well, no. Not everyone has a museum. I just think of it that way. So which means that I take it not kind of like, wow, I have my own museum. I mean, what it basically is the place that I was born in and grew up in Austria, in a town called Thal, T-H-A-L. They made this home basically kind of in the museum, where they put my original weights that they used when I was 15 years old, where they used some of my props in movies, that they have the original desk there from my governorship. in Sacramento. They have the original motorcycle from Terminator 2. And they have all kinds of different things in films and videos and documentaries and all that stuff. So it's a wonderful place to go through, and it gets, a few hundred people coming there every week, and schools coming there, kids as a motivational thing. And so, but I don't. What I'm saying is, I don't go home in the same and say, "Wow, I have my own museum." I never really think about it. That's about my. But I go there all the time and visit it, and they always like to see me there when I go to Graz
or
when
excited.
I go to Vienna to go there. And as you have seen, the mayor there of Tal, he's very excited about it, and the governor is very excited about it. The president of Austria came by, the chancellor of Austria. So they all come there and they make events out of it, and we create events there for various different people.
I want to ask you about maybe a little bit less of a comfortable topic. We've been talking about your time as governor. When you were running initially in 2003, this is 15 years ago, right? Towards the end of the campaign, there were some women who spoke out about behavior of yours that they called offensive. You apologized for it and said you didn't mean to offend. But obviously, not only is it 15 years ago, but it's the last 6 months have really changed the conversation that we're having about what's going on. What is the difference between that moment and now?
Well, I think that, first of all, the movement that you're talking about, the Me Too movement, it is about time. I think it's fantastic. I think that women have been used and abused and treated horribly for too long. And I think that now all of the elements came together to create this movement, and it now finally puts the spotlight on this issue. And I hope that a lot of people learn from that. And I remember that when I, for instance, when this happened to me just before the election with the groping charges, I realized, even though you say this was very politically motivated, it was just the day before, 2 days before the election and all this stuff. But the fact of the matter is, you got to take this thing seriously, because you got to look at it and say, okay, I made mistakes and I have to apologize. And this is why the first thing that I did when I became governor was that we had a sexual harassment class. Because I said to myself, this is extremely important of an issue. And now we are representing the people of California. So no one should get into this kind of trouble. No one. And so we had these people come in as experts. And it was really the most unbelievable education. And I recommend for anyone that is confused about this issue, after all of these complaints that women have and the outcry of women, I would suggest to everyone, if you're still confused about it, that women are not treated the right way, to go and to take one of those classes. Because when we took this class and the guy walked in, it was two women and two guys that were holding this class, and they said, let me just open up and just say very simply, if a woman comes to sit this door, and you, governor, say to her, I love your beautiful red dress, she can take this as sexual harassment.
Has it made you
And so here's the important thing that he said, but if you go at the same breath and say to the man, I like your green tie, he says, then it wouldn't be. So there were so many subtle kind of things that you needed to know that you would make mistakes. And the entire time that we were in office, we never had one single problem, because we had those sexual harassment classes on an ongoing basis.
Has it made you rethink your own things that you did, even in the last couple months?
No, I just think that we make mistakes, we don't take it seriously, but then when you then really think about it, you say to yourself, yeah, maybe there was, I went too far. You know, if you do sex scenes in a movie, scenes in bed, if you're in the gymnasium and you teach someone how to train and you maybe touch them in an appropriate way or say, whatever it is, you realize you got to be very sensitive about it, and you got to think the way women feel. And if they feel uncomfortable, then you did not do the right thing, and you got to be sensitive about that. And so, It just made me think totally differently. And then when this whole spotlight came about and the spotlight was put on this issue, I said to myself, finally, because I think that it is really good that now the spotlight is on it. It is no different than the spotlight was on it like on inequality in America, you know, in the 60s, or if it is about environmental issues where you talk and talk and talk about it, but then finally it clicks and people realize, I mean, for how long have I thrown things out of the window when I was a kid? And then eventually the spotlight was put on it and it made you feel bad that you're doing the wrong thing. And now you start thinking about it and you never do it again. So I think this is going to put the spotlight on it to such an extent that guys are going to think twice about it to make those mistakes. And I think that everyone should take a sexual harassment class because we got to go and not ever do those kind of things.
Is the problem worse in politics or in Hollywood?
I think it is across the board. I think it has nothing with Hollywood. It has nothing with politics. It can be somewhere at the factory. It can be in the military. It can be anywhere. This abuse and this kind of where guys flex their muscles and use their power in order to get certain things. And I just don't think it is right. And I think this is why it's good that women are letting their voice be heard.
Towards the end of his time as president, Bill Clinton wrote you a letter. And at the end of the letter, he said to you that you should think about becoming a Democrat. He didn't take your advice. Or rather, you didn't take his advice. You have been elected as a Republican. You have problems with the Republican Party. Are you a Republican for life? Have you thought of the Republican Party is changing every day. It's becoming President Trump's party in the way that most of the people in it are acting.
Well, first of all, I mean, Bill Clinton wrote me this nice letter, and you know, I would write the same to him, you know, and say, we should become a Republican. And a lot of people thought so.
In you still
when
have that
was, when he was praying, I still have the letter. Yeah.
Where is it?
It's still hanging at my house. it's a fun letter because you know, I was kind of like, you know, supporting him on some of the issues, and I think he appreciated it and wrote me a letter. But the bottom line is I'm a Republican, and I'm a true Republican. And I always will be a Republican. I will never leave the Republican Party. Because the Republican Party is a fantastic party, except it has veered off to the right and in some strange land. And if you think about myself as a Republican, I think about yesterday I saw the movie Lincoln that
you
was directed by Spielberg.
Pardon me? You just saw Lincoln?
Yeah, no, it's the second time. Okay. Actually, the third time.
You have a giant my friends, Lincoln bust outside here.
I have several Lincoln stuff all over the house. I just think that after I came over here, you know, I learned about Lincoln and the kind of things that he did, what a powerful president he was, and about, you know, freeing the slaves. And this was the Republican Party I'm talking about. It's the ones that voted for freeing the slaves, the ones that voted that they should become U.S. citizens, the ones that voted overwhelmingly to have voting rights, and on and on and on. So that's the Republican Party. Or Ronald Reagan, I remember when I came to America, and he created the Air Resources Board in California because we had so much smog. And he wanted to get rid of the smog. He was upset about the smog. He didn't look at it as a Republican issue, Democratic issue. He created the Air Resources Board that we are using now today in order to lower our greenhouse gases by 25% and accomplish of our goals. Let me just finish for a second. The President Nixon, who did universal health care and wanted to reform that, who created the EPA as a Republican. President Reagan, who dealt with the acid rain and did the Montreal Protocol, all environmental issues. President Bush with the acid rain, you know, made the agreement, international agreement, and then he had cap and trade. So the list goes on and on of great work that was done by Republicans. But today, those are all things that are absolutely a no-no in the Republican Party. So I didn't change. It's the Republican Party that has changed. And now we have to work very hard to get the party back again of where it was, because in California, for instance, I told them 11 years ago that they're losing at the box office. That they're wiping out
at the box office.
and they were very upset about it. Yeah. And sure enough, at that point, they had like 34% we had Republicans. Now we have only 26% of Republicans in California. So it just shows you that it's literally dying. And it is because they're stuck with an ideology that doesn't fit anymore to what really people want. If you think about it, that only 27% or so of Californians say the Republican Party is on the right track. Even amongst the Republican Party, Republicans in California, 60% of them say it's okay, and 40% say no, it's going off in the wrong direction. So I mean,
would you get involved in campaign? Wrong. You're pretty much done with politics. Would you campaign in 2020 against this strain in the Republican Party, against President Trump?
No, we have to fix the system. We have a press event in Los Angeles together with the Republicans that are more moderate Republicans or true Republicans. And we're going to talk about that, the new way to go as a Republican, because the Republicans that really the new thinking Republicans in California want to work together with the Democrats in order to get things done for the state and for the people. Because ultimately, I always tell every politician, ultimately, you are a public servant, not a party servant.
You have been talking to John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, who ran against President Trump in 16. You think he should run for president? Should he run as a Republican, or should he run as an independent?
No, I think that John Kasich should run as a Republican. He's a great Republican. He's fantastic. The job he's doing in Ohio, he was one of the best governors of all times. And when he was in Congress, he was the one that really negotiated and worked out the budget with the Clinton administration so they get rid of the deficit and the debt. And may I remind you, I mean, it just shows you about how important it is to really meet in the middle and to be able to go and work with Democrats and Republicans. I mean, you know, Ronald Reagan was a master in that with Tip O'Neill. When Tip O'Neill was the speaker, they met after 5 o'clock and they had their drink and they talked.
Right.
And they worked things out. Democrats and Republicans worked things out. And it was the most unbelievable progress during the 80s. And the same thing happened during the 90s with the Clinton administration, when Clinton was forced into listening and working with the Republicans because they won the House and the Senate in 1994. So there was Clinton being the Democrat in the White House. He had to work with the Republicans, which then they called triangulation,
right,
when he said, okay, fine, I'm going to take an idea from the Republicans, from the Democrats, and I meet in the middle, and I'm going to declare now victory on that. So he came out in his State of the Union address and said that the era of big government is over.
Right.
So the Democrats looked at him and said, oh my God, this is like a Republican talking. But he was very smart. And that's what you need to do. You got to go and work with Democrats and Republicans to make the action happen. And he was an expert in that too. So Ronald Reagan, him, were absolute experts in working together with both of the parties.
I wanted to ask two more questions and get to the audience questions. Do we need this? Oh, okay. You've got an environmental conference coming up in Vienna in May. Is that the extent of your environmental involvement at this point? Are you going to be doing more than convening people? What does it look like now?
Well, in Vienna, the conference is all about putting the spotlight on this issue of the environment. So I believe, just like in the promotion of fitness and bodybuilding, that the more often you talk about it and the more you go around the world and explain to people what it is, the more they start taking it seriously and the more knowledge there's out there. And so what this is basically, it's a partnership with the R20, which is my environmental organization that I've created after I became governor, and after I finished actually the governorship, and with the Austrian government. The idea is, because Austria is really extraordinarily good with the environment. And I said, why don't we do that? California is like number one with environmental issues. Austria is leading in Europe. Why don't we form a partnership between California and Austria? And so this is what this is about, is to help the UN and to help the international treaty, COP21, which is the international agreement of all the countries to go and to reduce greenhouse gases all over the world. And I think it's just a very, very important thing to do. And I think it is also important that for people to really focus on that issue, because this is no different than the smoking issue. The tobacco industry knew for years and years and years and decades that smoking would harm people, would kill people, would create cancer, and they were hiding that fact from the people and denied it. And then eventually they were taken to court and they had to pay hundreds of billions of dollars because of that. Because they knew.
So the same thing
is now with the oil companies. The oil companies, because people don't know that, but the oil companies knew from 1959 on, they did their own study and knew there will be global warming and climate change happening because of fossil fuels. And on top of it, it will be risky for people's lives, that it will kill people and they will get cancer and all this. All of this stuff the oil companies knew, and they kept hiding it from the people. This is why we are now talking to law firms to go and do exactly the same thing as they've done in the tobacco industry, where we sue the oil companies for knowingly killing people all over the world. There are 7 to 9 million people dying every year because of pollution, because of fossil fuels.
That's some big news. You're going to back class action suits against...
We're going to go after them, and we're going to be in there like an Alabama tick. That I can promise you. Because to me, it is absolutely irresponsible to know that your product is killing people and do not have a warning label on it like they do in tobacco. They had to settle and they had to put a warning label on that if you smoke, it will kill you. If you smoke, you will get cancer. It has a warning label. Every gas station should have a warning label on it. Every car should have a warning label. Every product that has fossil fuels in it should have a warning label on it. We should let people know so they understand that this is bad and they can go to an alternative route, which is to go to a combustion engine. This is a hydrogen engine or to electric cars or hybrid cars or something that will reduce the pollution in America and around the world.
So when do you expect to file?
Well, we don't know yet exactly, and we don't want to signal our moves. But I mean, one thing I can tell you, this is exactly what's going to come. Because I don't think there's any different that if you walk into a room and you know you're going to kill someone, it's first-degree murder. I think it's the same thing with the oil companies. They know they're killing people, and they continue doing the same thing over and over and selling it. So I think something needs to be done about it.
All right, let's end on, and then we're going to go to the audience questions. The new Terminator movie starts shooting over the summer. What can you tell us about it? Well, I mean, because it is kind of weird. He was governor of California for 7 years, and we're making another Terminator movie, right?
Why is that weird?
You're the only governor of California to star in a Terminator movie after leaving office.
I tell you, well, it's an interesting story because in this one, this just shows you how big Donald Trump is.
Oh, yeah? He's a character?
No, because, I mean, in the new Terminator movie, they wrote him in.
Really?
It's crazy, yeah, because the Terminator, the T-800 model that I play, he's traveling back in time to 2019 to get Trump out of prison. So, I mean, it's like it's an interesting story. You asked for it.
Yeah. I did ask. Is there anything you can actually tell us about the movie?
No. All jokes aside, the movie is going to start in June, and we will be shooting in Spain and in Hungary, and it probably will take around 4.5 months to shoot. I am still the T-800 model, the original Terminator, and the movie will come out the following year in the summer. And I cannot tell you anything about the story or the storyline or anything like that because I'm strictly forbidden to talk about that by Jim Cameron himself. He says, this time we cannot tell anyone anything. I say, okay, that's fine. But I'm looking forward to it. And this is the great thing about my life is that I go from, fighting for redistricting reform and getting rid of gerrymandering to doing an environmental event or coming from the Arnold Classic, the biggest sports and fitness festival in the world that we have been organizing for the last 30 years, to doing an event right here and to do a Q&A here, then to go to a movie and to the Terminator. And we have just finished writing the script for Triplets, which is the sequel to Twins we will be doing also.
Who's the third?
Conan is
Eddie
Murphy.
Okay.
Eddie Murphy is going to be the third one, so you can imagine. Exactly. Very funny. So there's something happened there with that mixing of the sperm. But in any case, then after that we do Conan, King Conan, which is also just being finished written. So there's, and then of course the TV series Outrider. With Amazon.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to that also. We will start doing that next year. So there's all of this. So I go from one to the next. So to the different kind of things including, I shouldn't forget, that I just came from skiing from Sun Valley,
that's
which just arrived here. Very, very important. Okay. They're very important. They're exactly. So I have a great life. And
let me ask you, there's an audience question up here. It's
heaven.
A perfect segue. When you were a kid, was there one moment that started you on this journey?
Was
and
there
that's,
one?
That's from an anonymous person.
But what was the question again?
When you were a kid, was there one moment that started you on this journey?
Well, there was a moment when we looked at a documentary, a black and white documentary about America. I was around 11 years old, 10, 11 years old, and this changed my life. When I saw in this documentary the high rises, when I saw the enormous bridges, the beautiful cars with the wings in the back, Hollywood and Muscle Beach and all of the kind of things, the beauty of America, I said, what am I doing here? And from that point on, I had this urge to go to America.
Well, let me combine that with another question that's up here. This is another anonymous question. Put your names on them. Come on. In a landscape of inequalities across America, is the American dream still possible? So combine that with the question that we were just asked.
The American dream is alive. I've seen it firsthand when I came over here that if you're willing to work hard, if you're willing to educate yourself, then you can make it. And the opportunities are here in America better than in any other place. I mean, I wouldn't have done what I did. If it is becoming a bodybuilding champion, getting in the movies, being a leading man in the movies, becoming governor, my family, everything that I've done, the amount of money that I've made, none of it would have been possible without coming to America. If I would have gone to Australia, it wouldn't have happened. If I would have gone to the Middle East, it wouldn't have happened. If I would have gone to Russia, it wouldn't have happened. Or to Africa, it wouldn't have. Nowhere. This is why I said earlier, America is without any doubt the greatest place in the world. Without any doubt. I mean, even today when we always think about, oh, there's so much turmoil here and there's so many problems. So still the day when we travel around, when I go, if it's the Oktoberfest in Germany or if it is going anywhere in the world, people come up to me and say, oh, my big dream is to come to America. My big dream is to come to California. My big dream is to go to New York, or whatever it is, but it's to America. That's the big dream. Even today, everyone wants to come to America. So this is the greatest place. Yes, we have problems. We have problems, but what country doesn't have problems? You know, the bottom line is we are still by far number one. We are by far the best. And I travel all over the world. So thank God we are in America.
Let's ask a more more Austrian-centric. My German pronunciation is not great. So it's what is better. Do you want to read what those are?
Kaiserschmarrn one or Apfelstrudel.
Okay. Now, I couldn't do that. And people may not know, but you actually have quite a sweet tooth. So
that's
why don't
right.
you tell us what the apple strudel and
I cannot really say which one is better because they both taste good, and I would go for both of them at the same time. So I would not choose for between one or the other.
That's the
I
Austrian.
I think it's just
Arnold.
Crazy. Exactly, it's the Austrian in me. So I mean, my mother was a very good cook, and so she cooked the best Wiener Schnitzel. And the best Kaiserschmarrn and the best Apfelstrudel and all that stuff she did. And when she came to America, when I moved to America, she came over and visited me. She trained everyone always at the house how to make Kaiserschmarrn and the Apfelstrudel and all this. And Kaiserschmarrn
is
basically...
It seems like good training for a bodybuilder.
Of course. I mean, there's eggs in it and protein. I mean, good protein. I mean, but it's delicious. And so Kaiserschmarrn, it means emperor's fluff, kind of. It's like a pancake cut up and made with eggs and flowers and so on. So it's healthy, but it's also a little fattening, I would say.
That seems factually correct. This is a good one to end on, maybe. It's another anonymous question here, unfortunately. Come on, nobody wants to put their names on these. How do you train your mind? You are. I think one of the things that struck me about you in conversations that we've had before today and today is that you are a little bit more of a wonk than people might guess the guy who was Mr. Universe would be or was best known for toting big guns around in the movies. So what do you do to keep up on this stuff?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of things, a lot of kind of interests or talents that we have that we don't even know. And so I was very fortunate to get involved in so many different issues. Like when I ran for governor, My wife always said to me, she says, you know, you're going to be so good in running because you're very competitive and you will figure out what will make you the winner. But I can tell you, I come from a family of politicians. Then sitting there and to actually work on a policy and having all these appointments and all this stuff, you would not like that. It would be very punishing. And, you know, I said to myself, well, I'm worried about that when I get there. I said, right now, it's all about winning and becoming governor. And so after I became governor, I started sitting down with my team, and we started talking about, you know, solving the certain problems. And sometimes they saw me sitting there still at 12 o'clock at midnight with the gang, trying to sort out things and figuring out how to solve a problem. And they looked at me and they said, well, what are you still doing here? Why did you go to bed? I mean, let us work on it. I said, no, I said, I can't. I said, I want to go to bed. I said, but I find this fascinating. I've never even heard the stuff that I've been just learning sitting here with you guys.
So I
just learned so much. And then you take home materials to read, special stuff that you read that applies to that. And you start reading on it and you start, you know, doing research on it and so on. So I became kind of a policy wonk and really started getting into it and myself being involved in getting things done. And I think it was very helpful for me. And I think it was very helpful to show to the other legislators and to other people that I was interested in it and in this various different subject. So it really helped me. So I think that mental stimulation was really terrific to work on environmental issues, to work on school issues, on prison issues, on infrastructure issues. And it goes back and forth. And at the same time, to work on, you know, on movie issues and to work on fitness issues and so on. So I think it's really stimulating for the mind. It's great. And then also, of course, as you know, I love playing chess,
yes,
which is another thing that keeps my mind always sharp. to just, you know, play whenever I have a chance to do that.
I have seen him hunched over a chessboard. It is not an image that you might expect, but it is for real. You apparently have won over some fans because there's a question here that I don't think we're going to get to about wanting you to run for governor of Texas, move here with all the other Californians who've moved to Austin, but you're not biting.
It sounds very good. But I think that Texas is doing really well. Texas, I just want to say that this is one of my favorite states. Always has been, because the Texans have this kind of a big mentality, big visions. Everything is big. When you look at their homes, their roads, their factories, their buildings, everything is big, 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 big. And so I just love that. And it's a wonderful and beautiful place, just like California. I mean, there's a few states like that that are just extraordinary states, and Texas is one of them. And, you know, this event here, South by Southwest, is a perfect example.
It's your first
of
time
thinking
here, right?
About, it's the first time I've been here. It's a perfect example of how big they think and how big they make events. And so congratulations to the great success of this.
I'm sure the South by Southwest people won't mind you ending on a plug for South by Southwest. So that's our conversation. I want to remind everybody, we're going to put this out on Tuesday morning as a podcast. Off message, please subscribe, tell your friends. You can see that picture of us at the Arnold Schwarzenegger Museum together on my Twitter account at Isaac Dover. Arnold Schwarzenegger, everybody.
Thank you, Isaac.
After we finished, Schwarzenegger insisted that we go boot shopping together. I did not buy any. Actually, neither did he. But you can see the photos of that a little bit on Twitter, too. Thanks to Zach Stanton for producing. Remember to subscribe for all the conversations coming up. Pete Buttigieg, Ricardo Rizzeo, Matt Gaetz, Jennifer Rubin, Michael Tubbs, many, many more. And catch you next time on Off Message.